to begin. As you know, the court returned to this hearing room in August, and we're delighted to be here, and a marvelous job was done. We still do have some problems with the audio system. So periodically, there has been a humming noise or feedback and fading in and out. So if you have problems in the audio system, it's not your fault, counsel, I don't think. Anyway, you've got the presumption it's not your fault. We'll proceed knowing that there may be difficulties. So I'll call 00-2841-CR State v. Robbins, Attorney Craig Albee, representing the defendant, Mr. Robbins.
May it please the court. My name is Craig Albee, and I represent Brian Robbins. Mr. Robbins is charged in a single count arising from an internet sting operation in which an adult police officer posed as a child. These facts give rise to three distinct issues in this case. First, is the child enticement statute constitutional as applied in this situation, given that there was no face-to-face contact between Mr. Robbins and the alleged victim, and that the statute does not require proof of knowledge of minority? Second, were Mr. Robbins' acts sufficient to demonstrate unequivocally that he would have committed this offense? Third, may this child enticement statute be applied to adults posing as children? I intend to take these issues in the order I've just stated. Before beginning with those issues, I would like to emphasize what this case is not about. This case is not about whether it is appropriate for law enforcement to engage in internet sting operations. This case is not about whether Mr. Robbins' conduct should be illegal. It's not about whether his conduct is offensive, and it's certainly not about whether the legislature could pass a statute criminalizing the conduct in this case. The question is whether the statute as written is unconstitutional and whether it applies to the conduct alleged against Mr. Robbins. Because the answer is no, I believe the charge against Mr. Robbins must be dismissed. If people find that result unfortunate, and I believe many people will, it is up to the legislature to rewrite the statute. But the statute as currently written is impermissible because it fails to include the knowledge requirement, and it does not impose criminal consequences for an erroneous belief regarding the age of the individual. Turning then to the constitutional issue, I begin with this issue, which I believe is the least complicated. It's the least complicated because this court has already paved the way, has performed the analysis in Zarnke and Widener. I believe this case clearly flows as a result of what the court decided in those cases, that there is no material distinction between this case, Widener, and Zarnke. In Widener, the defendant was charged with disseminating harmful materials to a child. The facts alleged in that case were that Mr. Widener knew that the person he was sending the materials to was, in fact, a child. Nevertheless, the court found the statute unconstitutional because it did not require any knowledge on Mr. Widener's part as to whether the person receiving the materials was an adult or a child. And the danger that the court was concerned about that led it to find that the statute violated the First Amendment was that adults who intended to disseminate harmful materials to other adults may unwittingly send them to children, and therefore adults were left with the choice of either not engaging in protected First Amendment conduct or risking a violation of a serious criminal statute. In Zarnke, the issue was whether distributors of pornographic material had to constitutionally have knowledge as to the age of the people depicted in the materials. Again, this court said that absent some knowledge requirement, there is a risk that innocent people engaging in protected activity would be prosecuted.
Now, counsel, I know that in your brief you are asking us to overrule the Comet case, you know, the case that came out of the Court of Appeals. What if you compare that case and what happened there, there were two young women involved, but the facts are quite similar to this one. What is the fatal flaw in that case as compared to this?
First, I should emphasize that COINC, is how I've been told it's pronounced, I'm not sure, did not address the constitutional issue in any way, shape, or form. So this court is the first appellate court of the state deciding that issue. Second, I don't believe that COINC is responsive to the arguments raised by Mr. Robbins in this case. There are several references by the Court of Appeals in that decision that issues were not fully briefed. I believe I've raised issues that, at least, I don't know whether they were raised by the defendant. They're certainly not addressed by the Court of Appeals. And the arguments that are addressed by the Court of Appeals, I think generally are ones I have not sought to raise in this case, because I would agree they're not particularly strong. So I really believe that this is on new ground, that this court isn't, technically, of course, the court would be overruling COINC, but COINC didn't have the advantage of full briefing or having these issues raised.
Mr. Albee, you mentioned Czarnecki and Widener, and I was just thinking when you were talking about it, you're talking about Widener involving harmful materials, Czarnecki involved the distribution of pornographic materials. We don't have the same situation here. We're not dealing with a speech component in this particular case. Doesn't that distinguish this situation considerably from Czarnecki and Widener?
With all due respect, Justice Crooks, I disagree, because in this as-applied challenge, we look at the conduct that's alleged against Mr. Robbins, and that conduct, the enticing conduct, which is the gravamen of the offense, is all consists of speech. It's a telephone call and principally internet communications. I think the case is Spence. We look to whether the defendant's conduct was imbued with communicative aspects, and I believe in this case it's entirely communication. And in Widener, age was the crucial element separating illegal conduct from lawful conduct. And the state has now confessed in a letter this week that this statute would apply to an adult sending materials to someone, making arrangements for a sexual liaison with another adult. And it would apply to that person if they inadvertently were sending it to a child, that those overtures were made to a child inadvertently. And so just as Widener was not arguing that he had a First Amendment right to send these kind of materials to children, and just as Czarnecki wasn't arguing that he had a First Amendment right to distribute pornographic materials containing children, we're not arguing that there's some First Amendment right to set up sexual liaisons with children. I mean, that's not what this case is about at all. But by the same token, the application of the statute to the communicative aspects that are involved would necessarily chill the expression of adults who wish to solicit sexual relationships through the internet. And there's no dispute that that's protected conduct, but the application of the statute would criminalize those people's communications if they inadvertently go to a child.
Well, I understand the argument, certainly, that the internet was being utilized here, that there was a phone call, but there are other actions here that tie into attempt, and those actions would have to do with traveling, as I understand it, from Wauwatosa to Little Chute, in order to further entice a child. Isn't that significant as well in this case?
I don't think so, because what the statute is directed at is the causing or attempt to cause. The travel doesn't accomplish that. All the attempt to cause is accomplished through the internet and the telephone. It's all done through communication. The fact that there's some incidental conduct that's alleged in this case. I mean, I suppose in the case of Widener or Czarnecki, you could talk about the preparations that the defendant took to commit the offense involved some conduct, some travel to obtain materials or whatever it might be. I think we, in this as-applied challenge, we look to what the focus of the allegation is against Mr. Robbins. And all those allegations deal with what he did over the Internet. That travel is not what's alleged to be illegal. It's what he did on the Internet. That's the problem here.
Is that distinguished from if this were not an attempt charge, but the cause charge, which would bring then conduct in issue and not, as you say, entirely communication?
I think that's right. The one example I can think of where even the causing still involve mostly communication is if arrangements were made, say, on the telephone to an unknown person and said, meet me in this hotel room or in this place, and the person went there, and then that's the first face-to-face meeting. And I think that just, again, highlights the problem with not having a knowledge requirement in the statute.
What would make this statute constitutional? Let's approach it in a different way. Then we'll see whether your standards of constitutionality are...
Well, I think... Simply including that knowledge requirement that as an element of the child enticement offense, you'd have to prove that the defendant knew that the person enticed was a child. Knowledge, as defined in Wisconsin statutes, incorporates belief. The legislature could choose to make that explicit or not, I think. Any time that knowledge is alleged, that also includes belief under the Wisconsin statutes.
So the legislature could enact a valid statute
in your opinion,
that said so long as the defendant believed that the person with whom he was communicating was a child.
Absolutely. And
that's the fatal flaw here.
I'm cut out for a second. That is the fatal flaw here?
Yeah, that's what your allegation.
Yes. I mean, if this statute required the state to prove in every instance that the defendant knew the age of the individual, it would pass constitutional muster as applied to these facts.
Now, you've made some argument that this would chill a speech if we were to hold this constitutional. I don't quite understand that because it's not that Mr. Widener or Mr. Robbins believed that he was communicating with an adult here. He believed he was communicating with a child, which is, as you just previously stated to me, can be legislatively prescriptive.
And certainly, we accept the state's allegations for purposes of these issues without otherwise acknowledging them. But that was also the situation in Widener, Justice Babich. That is, the allegations against Mr. Widener were that he knew the person receiving his materials was an underage person to whom he could not send those to legally.
But the problem in Widener was that the burden was on the defendant to show lack of knowledge, and the court said no, it's an element that the state has to prove. Isn't that right?
Yes, but that problem is aggravated in this case because the defendant doesn't even have the opportunity to present an affirmative defense.
Okay, but I think that Justice Babich might have been asking you was, even if this was in the statute, the requirement that the state prove that the defendant here knew, had reason to know, believed, and you used several of these words, that the child was under 16 here, that he'd be guilty.
There'd be probable cause to set him up for trial, yes.
On these facts. So the issue really isn't whether your client would be might be convicted under a constitutional statute. Your point is this one isn't constitutional.
That's correct. That's correct.
So now, why does it inhibit? Why does it inhibit speech? Why does that's very difficult. You've got to get over the conduct speech dichotomy, to me anyway.
Okay. In this case, for example, let's assume that Mr. Robbins is communicating with a 42-year-old man who represented himself as such. I believe Mr. Robbins, in that case, would have a constitutional right, and there's certainly been no disagreement with that proposition from the state here, to engage in communications of a sexually explicit nature with that person and to make arrangements.
Okay, suppose that this was a 15-year-old who passed himself off as 42 on the Internet. And now we find out he's really 15. Have you violated 948.07?
Yes, you have violated it, and that's precisely why the statute's unconstitutional, because it does not contain that knowledge requirement. Because that that's the constitutional problem here, is that the person who wants to engage in these conversations with the 42-year-old has to take the risk that 42-year-old actually would be a 15-year-old, and then has violated one of the more serious felonies we have in the books.
That's the opposite of this case, where it's thinks he's 13. E. Robbins thinks the person at the other end is 13.
Yes.
He's really 42.
Yes.
How can you have an intent to have sexual contact with a child when you're dealing with a child who says that he's 42? I mean, the person on the other end is representing that they're 42. How could the person then have an intent to have sexual contact with a child?
They don't, but that's the problem with the statute. They don't have to have such an intent to have it with a child.
Well, what does the language intent to commit any of the following acts mean then? You have to have intent to commit sexual conduct or intercourse with a child less than 16.
Well, I think that would relate to the attempt to cause. When the attempt is alleged, you're intending to cause the person on the other end, who is a child. You're no longer alleging the attempt in respect to whether the recipient of the communication is a child. You're alleging the attempt because you haven't actually caused that person to enter a room with the intent to have sexual contact.
You're saying that if he passes himself off as 42 when he's really 13, you're intending to have sexual contact or intercourse with a 42-year-old. You can't, obviously, because the kid's 13. That you won't be clipped under cause, but you will be charged with attempt. Is that your point?
You'll be charged with attempt, and under 939.23 sub 6, you cannot defend yourself by saying, I thought it was a 42-year-old.
You've talked in your brief about the intent element in an attempt. The intent is to have sexual contact with a child. In the hypothetical, the intent is to have sexual contact with an adult.
Yes.
So that the fact that you're talking to a child doesn't change the situation. Your intent is to have sexual contact with an adult, and that is not a violation of the statute.
The state's letter this week confesses that would be a crime, Your Honor, and I agree with the state.
Which
on that.
Which letter of date is that, counsel?
Letter of January 9th. They've withdrawn their position to the contrary and acknowledge that because 939.23 sub 6 and 939.43 sub 2 prevent the person from defending that and say, hey, I had every reason to believe this was an adult, that they could be convicted, even though all representations were that the child was an adult, they could be convicted of that crime for unwittingly having these communications with the child.
We don't always accept what the state says.
I understand, but I and neither do I. But in this case, I do, because 939.23 sub 6 clearly says that is not a defense in these cases. And that's why I don't think there's any way to save this statute by rewriting it, is because the legislature has made clear that intent is not to come into play in these kind of prosecutions.
Isn't that just slightly off the mark? Hasn't the legislature said that knowledge of the victim's age is not to come into play as a defense, or absence of knowledge of the victim's true age, or mistake as to the victim's true age is not to come into play? But this is not a pure strict liability crime. It is a strict liability crime, as are the sex crimes against children, with respect to the issue of the victim's age. But there is a mens rea to this crime. There's a mental element.
With respect to other elements, but it is strict liability as to age, and that's why in Justice Prosser's example, that person would be criminally liable and can't defend it by saying, I didn't know and I couldn't have known.
Right, and what's the purpose of that? What's the legislative purpose of doing that?
In most cases, it would be to protect children and prevent, and in face-to-face sorts of situations, to put the risk on the person who wants to have sexual contact with the young person. And you know, this is one of those situations where I think the statutes, which were enacted long before Al Gore invented the internet, I think it just isn't tailored to this sort of new situation, and it has to be rewritten when we want to expand areas of law enforcement. There are some unforeseen consequences of new technology, and I think this is one of them. And as Justice Babich was inquiring, this statute can be rewritten so that it encompasses belief. I mean, you could just add something about a person who represents himself as a child, perhaps, or is believed to be a child. But right now, as written, the statute clearly requires a child involved, and that it's not a defense.
Counsel, I don't know if that's. Did you want to say? I don't know if that's so readily apparent in looking at the words of 948.07, and I think the reason that we're here, in fact, in part, in looking at those words. The statute indicates that whoever with intent to cause or attempts to cause any child who has not attained the age of 18 years. We can interpret that one of two ways. I'm focusing on the word child. Does that have to be a child in fact? Or is the statute to be interpreted as though it is intended to be a child? What's wrong, if anything, with my bifurcated interpretation of that?
And I want to keep issues sort of distinct, and it's my fault because I let one seep into the constitutional issue, because I think this is now outside the realm of the constitutional issue, but to the third issue about whether the person has to be, in fact, a child. I believe that language of the statute, and as it's been interpreted for all this time until there's an attempt to expand the application of the statute, has been interpreted to require an actual child.
Well, and, but you're, this is a new day dawns, you know, and this is an as-applied challenge. There's reason to interpret it perhaps as a child. I mean, I'm just arguing before, because you were talking about generally face-to-face contact. But this new day that has dawned is the Internet, and the Internet relationships that can be established without face-to-face contact. So as we are applying it in the Internet relationship, does it need to be a child, in fact, and you're right, we're seeping into the third issue, or can it just be intent to be a child?
I believe as written, the legislature has determined that belief as to age is irrelevant. I think it's done that in 939 in two separate sections, and there's no contrary indication in 948.07, and the jury instruction also adopts the language of 939 and says we are not to consider belief as to age, and that's why I believe it would require a judicial rewriting of the statute, which is contrary to the principle that the legislature must draft the statutes in order to affect that result.
You know, this statute has an attempt written right into it. How do you deal with that and then also deal with the attempt statute? Seems to me you ought to have one or the other. I didn't look through the statute books to see if other statutes have an attempt right within it rather than rely on the attempt statute.
It certainly confuses things in this instance, Chief Justice. I read the attempt as modifying only the to cause in this statute. I have not made this challenge, but I frankly believe that this type of charge shouldn't lie unless there is also an allegation of 939-30-32. We're stretching it awfully thin when we've got two separate types of attempt. I think the attempt envisioned by that statute is solely the attempt to cause, and not an attempt based on facts not known to the defendant.
This is an attempt to cause the child to go into the building. That's what you're
talking about. Yes. I mean, that is trying to get the child in the building but not succeeding at getting the child to go in the building. Let me address... That's time.
Your red light's on, yeah. So you use your time, but you do have 5 minutes. Nashhold, Attorney General Nashhold, representing the state of Wisconsin. To lower the lifter and know the button is still there.
Has my time started? May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashold, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this matter. On February 5th, 2000, Brian Robbins, who was then 46 years old, attempted to meet with a 13-year-old boy, get him into his car, bring the boy to a hotel room, and have sex with him. There's no dispute that this is what Robbins was attempting to do. He admitted it to police officers. There's also no doubt that he knew what he was attempting to do was illegal. In an internet message to the boy, he stated, "This isn't legal, you know." What prevented Robbins from completing the crime was that, contrary to his belief, the person he was attempting to entice was not a 13-year-old boy, but was in fact an adult undercover agent. Now, Robbins argues that the child enticement statute, 948.07, requires a real child. This position was directly refuted by the Court of Appeals in Coink. And while this court may certainly overrule Coink, there's just no good reason to do so in this case. Coink is consistent with the child enticement statute. It's consistent with precedent from this court in Dams, from the Court of Appeals, in the Cordes decision, and with authority from other jurisdictions directly dealing with this type of internet sting operation with statutes that are legally indistinguishable from the statute we're dealing with in this case. It's also consistent with the public policy of protecting children. As the state stated in its brief, we do not want to wait for a situation where a real child has been affected, and this is a legitimate means of intervening before that happens.
Counsel?
Counsel, I was going to ask the same question I asked the opposing counsel, because he said when I talked about the point case that you brought up, that that really isn't on point for what he is arguing today as far as the constitutionality of 948.07. In other words, he says that that makes no difference. His point is different. What's your response?
He is making three arguments in this case, one of which was directly addressed in Coink, which is that the enticement statute does not, it cannot be used in this situation where there's no real child involved. And that situation, that legal issue, was directly addressed in Coink, and it explicitly rejected that idea. But it's also important to point out that even though Coink did not directly address the constitutional issue in this case, it rejected a fundamental premise of Mr. Robbins's argument in this case, and that is that under the facts of this case, that no scienter element is required. Under the facts of this case, the state has argued again and again that where you do not have a real child involved, the state must prove that the defendant believed that the person with whom he intended to entice was in fact a child. So you do have that scienter element, and the court stated so in Coink, and therefore the defendant's constitutional argument would fail if this court also agreed with Coink.
Seems to me you want a win-win. And that's not bad, but I want a win-win too, but you just said under the facts, when you do not have a real child involved, so what I mean by win-win really are the two interpretations that I gave to the statute before. You win when there's a real child involved, and you win when there isn't a real child involved. I use that as a preface to raise concern of your letter, and I need you to address your letter, because as I understand the state's position as set forth in this letter, withdrawing some language from your brief, that if I, well, I don't want to use myself as an example, if there is a 40-ish person, 50-ish person, who is on the internet and wants to set up a rendezvous with another person of comparable age, and you have a 13-year-old on the internet posing as a person of comparable age. Under that fact situation, a 13-year-old posing as a 50-year-old, and that would subject the initiator to criminal liability, when the only thing the initiator intended was to arrange a rendezvous with a 50-year-old person, attempt to arrange a rendezvous. He stopped as they're getting out of their car, so they don't even walk into the location of the rendezvous. That seems problematic to me.
I have a number of responses to that. First of all, this is an as-applied challenge to the child enticement statute. And that's a very important point, because This scenario that we have discussed and that was mentioned in the letter is a different factual scenario that, if it is before this court, the court can address the constitutionality of the statute as applied in that context. But he has not raised a facial challenge to the statute here. He's only talking about the situation where you do not have a real child, where you have an undercover officer posing as a child, and is the statute as applied constitutional in this context? And that is what is before the court. Now, the reason that I wrote that letter and that we withdrew the language from the brief stating that that scenario could not be charged under the statute is that in looking at the mistake statute, 93943, as well as the criminal intent statute, 93923, we came to the conclusion that whenever you have a real child, those statutes bar the mistaken belief as a defense. Now, what Mr. Robbins keeps saying in his brief is that those statutes make belief irrelevant. That is not the case. Those two things are not the same. To say that that mistake as to the age of an actual minor is not a defense, and to say that belief is always irrelevant under the child enticement statutes are not the same thing, and those two things should not be conflated. All those statutes do is say that when you have a real child, you cannot raise this defense. And the legislature had legitimate reasons. The defense that I believed that it was an adult.
Well, would you concede that it is constitutionally protected behavior for an adult to communicate over the internet with another adult with respect to a sexual liaison? Is that protected speech?
Yes, that is protected speech. But,
well, if under your interpretation, it strikes me that you would be chilling that protected speech if a person believed that he was communicating with an adult, therefore engaging in protected speech, if in fact it is a child posing as a speech. Would you agree with that?
Well, the state has asserted in its brief and believes that this is well supported by authority, that as Justice Abramson was getting to, this is not the child enticement statute is not a speech regulation. It does not regulate the content of speech. It deals with conduct. And the state has cited a number of cases in its brief, Kufrovich, Powell, and Bailey, which explicitly say that. This is on page 33 of the state's brief, where they've made the distinction between a statute which governs the content of speech, such as those in Widener and Czarnecki, and a statute like this, where it's covering conduct, that of enticing a child. And so, therefore, the state's position is that we don't even need to prove a scienter element when addressing the constitutionality of the child enticement statute in this case.
Well, Ms. Nassau, what about the argument of your opponent that speech is very much at issue here, that the communication was through the internet, the communication was by telephone, and that's very key to an as-applied challenge? How do you handle that?
I handle that by responding that there are many, many crimes that involve speech as either the primary or even the sole way of committing a crime, and yet we wouldn't look at those statutes and say that these are speech statutes, that these govern the content of speech. Some examples are perjury, bomb scares, intimidation of victims, communicating with jurors with intent to influence, false complaints of police misconduct, threats to a witness, threats to injure or accuse of a crime. I mean, the list goes on and on, and this point was made in the three cases cited by the state, where even though the crime necessarily involves an element of non-face-to-face communication, or that is the only way the crime can be committed. It does not necessarily render it a speech regulation. And they cite, in those cases, they cite Supreme Court authority for this position and a number of other cases where courts have had to draw those lines. And admittedly, it is a hard line to draw between speech regulations and conduct regulations. But it is a line that courts have to draw again and again in determining First Amendment cases.
Are you saying that the state could constitutionally limit or prohibit even a sexual liaison, sexual conduct between two consenting adults?
If this court follows the legislature's statutes in the mistake statute and the criminal intent statute, then the child enticement statute would not bar that.
I'm not talking about a child enticement statute. I'm talking about a statute that says two adults can't engage in sexual conduct.
Yes, if the person is a child, then...
Oh, that's a contradiction in terms. I'm drawing up a hypothetical.
Oh, you're saying the person is not is in fact an adult?
Yeah.
No, then no. I'm sorry. I thought you were saying that it was a child posing as an adult.
Why does it make a difference in this case for the state to say, well, this is a conduct statute and not a speech statute? Because if it's a conduct statute, it is still, because you don't require knowledge that the person is a child, it is still prohibiting legitimate conduct, or at least legal conduct and constitutional conduct between two adults.
Because the requirement of a scienter element comes into play when you have a statute governing speech. And in Widener, this court viewed the statute in that case, distributing harmful materials to a minor, as a variable obscenity statute. And the same can be true of the child pornography statute in Zarnke, that those were cases directly limiting speech, whereas this case is a case directly trying to get at a defendant's conduct, even though the enticement may occur through speech. And I just wanted...
Why do they have to be mutually exclusive? In Widener, you have the dissemination of sexually explicit materials. There's a much easier speech component. But why doesn't this statute involve both initially communication over the internet, which sure sounds a lot like speech to me when I'm talking about communication over the internet, and conduct? In other words, this statute can be looked at as a statute which, if you want to use kind of legalese, implicates speech in addition to conduct.
Well, I don't think just because a statute incidentally implicates speech, or even primarily implicates speech, that it is necessarily a speech code. And that's exemplified by the statutes I referred to earlier, where speech is the primary means of affecting the crime. But it's important for a number of reasons. The reason why I want to make this distinction between a statute that regulates speech versus conduct is that a number of ramifications ensue depending on which way this court goes. For one thing, as stated in Mr. Robbins's brief, there's a presumption that statutes are constitutional. And that's very important in this case because you're asking defense counsel about, well, how easy would this be to rewrite, et cetera. But if there's no need to rewrite it, in part because of the presumption of constitutionality, then that becomes very important. And whereas when a statute does not govern speech, then there is a presumption of constitutionality, and the defendant has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute is unconstitutional. Whereas if it is a statute that regulates speech, then the burden shifts to the state to show that it's constitutional. And in this case, I don't think that burden ever shifts to the state. And in addition, regarding whether charges would be properly brought in the scenario that is set forth in the letter to the court and that this court is concerned with, there's the determination of whether any prosecutor would want to charge in that situation. I mean, it's a practical matter that's going to be very difficult to prove, if not impossible, because of the fact that, especially if the communications were all that occurred and you didn't have any traveling or anything like that, that you might not have enough there to constitute an attempt because you don't have sufficient acts. So in the purely internet context where it's just internet communications and no travel, it would be a very difficult, if not impossible, offense to prove. The other reason that this case is not purely a speech type of case is that the defendant did more than just communicate over the internet. He made arrangements to meet with this person who he believed was 13 years old. He drove all the way from Wauwatosa to Little Chute to meet with this person. And so we're not dealing with a purely a speech type of situation. And although defense counsel argues that, well, the only way that this was a charge was through the speech, that is not the case. The travel is part of the attempt. It's what the defendant did in addition to the communication to try to get this person to meet with him, to take him to the motel room. So here, there's not only speech, but conduct as well.
So you do admit that there is a speech component to this?
Absolutely, there's a speech component.
Under the state statute regulating sexual assault of a child, 948.02, you think that the person is 18, really 13, guilty?
I'm sorry, under which statute?
948.02, sexual assault of a child who hasn't attained the age of 13. You think that 15, 17 is sexual contact or intercourse guilty?
If you have a victim who is underage and you don't, and you believe that the person is not underage, guilty.
Okay.
Mistake is not a defense.
All right. I have trouble in this case. And separating out impossibility, fact, and law. Can you help me on that?
Impossibility has to do with whether if a person completed the or intended to complete the crime, there would have been an actual crime, and it's defined in the briefs, both legal and factual impossibility. And without knowing exactly what problem you're having with the distinction between
what about this case? Is it fact or law?
This case,
impossibility or factual impossibility?
The state's position that it's a mistake of fact, and Fave characterizes it as that as well, and so do a lot of the cases that the state refers to in its brief. And the defendant has conceded that in mistake of fact cases, there's not a defense based on that.
What if it were a legal mistake? Has the defense of legal impossibility been abolished in this state? Does it exist?
Based on the decision in Cordes and in Dams, the state would submit that there is no impossibility defense in Wisconsin, and that the courts have not embraced the idea that impossibility is a defense.
Did Cordes actually go that far and eliminate the defense of legal possibility?
Well, in ruling the way it did,
it really characterized the issue there as a case of factual impossibility under Dams and sidestepped the issue of whether
it did say we do not need to address whether Wisconsin has adopted, but The state urges the court not to make a distinction between factual and legal impossibility, as many jurisdictions have done, and to simply state that when impossibility is raised as a defense, it's illegitimate.
Whether it's legal or factual.
Right.
But we don't have a Wisconsin case that says there's no impossibility defense, legal or factual. This is it.
This is...
Or maybe it.
Maybe it is, if you need to reach that.
I thought that there was a case that you cited that said factual impossibility is not a defense in Wisconsin.
That factual impossibility, Justice Sykes was
right.
referring
but,
to legal.
But legal
right.
is different.
And when Hammer and Donahue, in their article, indicate the modern trend in most jurisdictions is to reject both factual and legal impossibility as a defense, they're not able to cite any Wisconsin case with regard to the legal impossibility.
Not that I'm aware of, but if you characterize this case as a case of legal impossibility, it would be difficult to say that a case such as Cordes or Cooper, which is the drug case where the person was intending to distribute a controlled substance, but it turned out that it was not a controlled substance. If you characterize those cases or this case as a legal impossibility, it would just be difficult to say that this case is or is not in the other cases are contrary to that, because they seem very analogous to me, that you know, you intended to do something, and but for the fact that the substance was not a controlled substance, or but for the fact that this was not a child as you believed, you would have committed the crime. And so I think the fact that in Cooper and in Cordes, you have a situation where that's very analogous to this case, and they've said that charges or conviction are appropriate in those cases.
In those cases,
is a good argument.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you had completed acts that were charged as attempts because of the legal status of the property in question.
You had repeated acts?
You had completed acts.
Oh,
the acts were complete. The act of receiving stolen property was complete. It was charged as an attempt in Cordes because the property wasn't stolen. Same situation with the drug case that you just mentioned. Here we have, as Mr. Albee argues, an attempted child enticement. It's an attempt on an attempt. It's an attempt in two senses. One, because the act was not completed, which is chargeable under this statute, under the plain language of the statute, but two, because the victim wasn't a child.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't think that analytically...
in two senses, which confuses the analysis.
I don't think that analytically it makes a difference whether Robbins was thwarted in one way or two ways, because what Cordes focused on was the idea that you needed the property to be stolen, and the court in Cordes said that even though for the completed crime, the property has to be stolen. For an attempt, it does not. And that is the crux of this case. Even though you need a child for the completed crime, that does not mean that you need a child for the attempted crime. And as to whether it's an attempt to attempt, I don't think that the fact that you have two ways in which Robbins was thwarted here makes it an attempt to attempt as contemplated in Durango, because what happened there was they did exactly what defense counsel says we should do. They applied the lower court, or the prosecutor rather, charged the attempt statute and in addition the child enticement statute, and the court said no, you can't have both because you can't have an attempt to attempt, so you can't use the attempt statute when attempt is already built into the child enticement statute. And here we don't have that. We're using the language of the attempt statute to define what attempt means in the child enticement statute, but we're not charging both statutes. So there's no violation of Durango, and in fact, we could not, contrary to defense counsel's position, use that general attempt statute in charging child attempted child enticement in this case.
So you're only using the attempt statute to define what the word attempts means in 948.07.
Right, and we've all been operating under that presumption in briefing. The defendant has never argued that we should look elsewhere to define attempt. That seems like the most logical place to look for a definition of attempt. And in response to your inquiry earlier, Justice Abramson, as to whether any other statutes have built in attempt in the statute, I believe that the possession of a controlled substance also contains an attempt that you can attempt under the statute too. As far as the defendant's third argument, whether there were insufficient acts to show that he was attempting, that is an issue that the state believes should really be decided by a jury. Certainly there was probable cause to believe that the defendant attempted to entice a child. One thing that I wanted to point out is that in the cases where courts from other jurisdictions have found that there was sufficient acts in furtherance of the attempts, such as Barner, Chen, Patterson, Van Bell, Hudson, many of those cases stated that there was enough evidence under fact situations very, very similar to this case, that there was enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intended to commit the crime. And those cases all involve statutes that are very similar to this case. And if you can find beyond a reasonable doubt that there was enough in those cases, I think certainly you can find that there was enough here to show that he was attempting to entice a child. Regarding the defendant's position in his brief that under Hamil you have to adopt this stop the film test, that you can't take his post-arrest statement that he was intending to meet with this 13-year-old boy to have sex. If he had made the statement to the police officer after his arrest, look, I was just driving there to tell him this is all a huge mistake, I doubt that defense counsel would be arguing for this stop the film test as to either element, either the intent or the sufficient acts element of attempt. Indeed, in Henthorne, a case heavily relied on by defense counsel, the court explicitly looked at post-arrest statements in determining whether the attempt was committed. The person in that case who was trying to fraudulently obtain prescriptions, or it looked as though she was trying to, made statements after her arrest that she knew that if she had done so, she would lose her nursing license. And that was one of the things that the court looked at in deciding whether she had committed the crime of attempt. And the court said in Henthorne that she did not.
I'm going to bring you full circle again, just so I understand your position. I get back to my hypothetical that I'm an adult who wants to have intercourse with or sexual contact with another consenting adult. I communicate only via the internet. We never meet. The person I think I'm talking to as an adult turns out to be a 14-year-old who's playing a hoax. Under that fact situation, it seems to me that might be a bit chilling if you can be charged with an attempt charge of child enticement. It seems like that is a bit chilling on adult behavior. Tell me why it isn't.
The legislature has said that where you have a real minor, you cannot allege that mistake as a defense. And that's why we're saying that under the statute that is permissible. If there was a situation where it involved pure internet communications and this court did not adopt the argument that the child enticement statute governs conduct and not speech, then maybe you would have to decide that there is a First Amendment problem in that context. But that is not the situation here, and which way the court goes in this case is not going to impact that situation as far as I can see, because we're saying that whenever you have a real child, you can charge, but that is not the situation here, that when you are charging attempt and there's no real child involved, then the person needs to believe, the defendant needs to believe that the person with whom he is dealing is a child.
Mr. Albee agreed that if you had a statute he thought was constitutional, his client could be prosecuted.
Under the statute, correct.
Under the revised statute. His complaint is that that's not the way the statute reads, and we shouldn't make it read that way when that isn't what the legislature adopted.
I couldn't hear the last part of your sentence.
Sorry. That we should not read knowledge or belief of the age of the communicant into the statute to make it constitutional.
Right. But it's not reading age into the statute. Attempt to cause a child is already built into the statute. So it's not reading into it to say that when you do not have a real child, you need to intend to cause a child. I see that I'm out of time. I just ask this court to affirm the trial court's decision in this case, which denied the defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint. The complaint was based on a factual and legal analysis that was sound.
Thank you, Ms. Nashold. Mr. Albee.
In addressing the question of whether this is speech or conduct or whether there's any First Amendment as applied questions here, I think the focus when we have a First Amendment as applied challenge is whether the statute is flawed in such a way that protected speech would be chilled by its application under the circumstances. And so the question here is this statute flawed in some way, namely the lack of knowledge, such that it will impinge upon protected speech? And the acknowledgement of the state in this case is that, yes, it would. It would impinge upon protected speech in that circumstance where an adult seeks to arrange a rendezvous with another adult and inadvertently has communications with a child. It does not become conduct as a result of the travel, no more than if you added to that fact scenario that we've been working with, where a 42-year-old is communicating with someone who says they too are 42 and they're actually 15, and then the person travels to meet the other person. That wouldn't suddenly take it out of the protected area because you went to travel to see the other person. And
counsel, don't we first, in a First Amendment challenge, look at the statute as applied to the facts of the case to see if it's actually regulating speech? And in this instance, Mr. Robbins is not being prosecuted because of what he said on the internet. He's being prosecuted for the steps he took in furtherance of a criminal intent, the evidence of which, in part, consists of what he said on the internet.
Oh, I think the acts of enticement, that is, as it's defined now, causing or attempting to cause the child, are entirely over the internet, with the exception of the phone call, which I think falls in the same area. That is the attempt to cause. The travel doesn't further the impact on the prospective victim. That in itself doesn't accomplish anything, and there's nothing unlawful about the travel in itself. The state's position, as I understand it, is that those communications are what's unlawful in this case.
Could one of these cases be prosecuted without the defendant having taken some steps to set up a liaison?
Frankly, under the way the statute's written, the defendant may have be in a better position to go to a jury and argue about what his intent was, but I think, frankly, as being applied here, you could probably have just charged Mr. Robbins even if he never took another step. I think that would be a jury issue. And that's just another reason why I think this is an improper application of the statute. It does, if the court does not follow Wiedner in this case, there's a big gap there in terms of the application of the statute to constitutionally protected conduct, and that's the main concern here, is that First Amendment problem.
Mr. Elby, you have, I believe, conceded, or at least you state that the statute could be rewritten to constitutionally cover this conduct. I take it would read something like, attempts to cause any person he or she believes to be a child.
Correct.
That would be okay. Now, why is it not appropriate for this court to interpret the legislative intent to be precisely that?
And I think that goes back to even the state's letter this week talking about 93923 sub 6 and the other provision is the legislature had, just as in Wiedner and Czarnecki where this court declined to do that, has clearly stated this is not a case where knowledge is a required element, and in those instances the court can't save the statute given the legislature's clear directive to the contrary.
And that is, what is the clear intent to the contrary? Is that found in the criminal intent and mistake statute? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. As well as the jury instruction for child enticement, which I understand is not a legislative determination, but the child enticement statutes, like the vast majority of the statutes in 948 involving children, are all the situations where mistake as to age is not to be considered.
I'm trying to get something clarified in my mind. If the person that Mr. Robbins was communicating with was 13 years old, is the statute still unconstitutional?
Yes. Yes, under these facts, because there needs to be a knowledge requirement. That really is the Wiedner situation, Your Honor, where Wiedner was engaging in the dissemination of harmful materials to someone who was in fact a child and who had represented herself to be a child, but it was the absence of the knowledge requirement.
So your position is that no kind of sting operation over the internet is valid under this statute, irrespective of who is on the other end.
I think that's true. It's a problem that I also believe is easily fixed by the legislature incorporating knowledge into this statute. And you know, again, that may be a problem with an unforeseen technology and a statute that was written long ago. But that's a problem that's easily fixed by the legislature.
The statute is perfectly valid in a whole lot of situations that don't involve the internet.
Face-to-face contact, yes.
Why is it that in those situations that the internet is involved that we can't read into the statute something? Put into the statute in order to save it?
For the reasons this court rejected that argument in Wiedner and Czarnecki, that is, the legislature clearly has spoken that is not to happen in applying these statutes.
Well, one member of the court didn't agree with this argument.
Well, but counsel, suppose it's face-to-face, and the person looks 20 and is really 13. Less than 13 here. Is your client? Would the person be found guilty of this statute, written as it is, without a knowledge or belief as to the age?
I'm sorry, I have trouble hearing a few
right.
words there. But as I understand, a 20-year-old and a 13-year-old face-to-face contact
But the 13-year-old looks like a 20-year-old.
That's the tough luck aspect of these statutes.
You think that's constitutional? Face to face, thinks that they're not dealing with a child, intends to have sexual contact. Person is under 18, under 13, guilty of 948.071.
That is constitutional.
That's constitutional.
It's tough luck for the defendant, not the state.
That's right. I mean, you act at your own peril in that situation, as opposed to the internet, where it's putting too great a burden on the communicator to determine who's on the other end of the communication.
Chief, may I ask a question? Yes. You indicate that you can save the statute by adding words like he or she believes to be a child.
Yes.
But following your argument, even if I would add that to the statute, and following your argument that there didn't even have to be travel in this case, even adding this to the statute, aren't you just criminalizing intent?
Well, and that's why I think you leave things to the legislature. I mean, whether there may be a problem there, I'd want to take a closer look at it, but you leave it to the legislature because at some point the legislature may balk at criminalizing intent. It may go too far, and it may be too far removed from actual acts, actual conduct, and so maybe they draft a statute that would try not to encompass things that really come down to being intent.
If this language doesn't fly, if this language then leads you to an argument in a situation where, oh, you're criminalizing intent because you don't even need travel, and so this language doesn't save it, then I get back to Justice Prosser. I mean, if this language doesn't save it, how can there be no sting type of investigation?
No, I do believe that language saves it. That if you have believes to be a child, going back to, I think, Justice Sykes' question, that's a jury question. I mean, whether a jury is willing to convict based on just the internet communications where the person says, let's attempt to meet, that may be a jury question. But all that's required is to put the knowledge requirement in here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Albee. Thank you, Ms. Nashold, both for the arguments presented here today. And that concludes the hearing.